Translation by Srila Prabhupada. The Lord was pacified after killing those kings who were burdensome to the earth. They were puffed up with their military strength, their horses, elephants, chariots, infantry, etc. He himself was not a party in the fight. He simply created hostility between the powerful administrators, and they fought amongst themselves. He was like the wind, which causes friction between bamboos, and so sparks a fire. Purport by His Divine Grace. And it's quite a long purport. As stated above, the living beings are not factual enjoyers of things which are manifested as God's creation. The Lord is the genuine proprietor and enjoyer of everything manifested in His creation. Unfortunately, influenced by the deluding energy, the living being becomes a false enjoyer under the dictation of the modes of nature. Puffed up by such a false sense of becoming God, the deluded living being increases his material strength by so many activities and thus becomes the burden of the earth, so much so that the earth becomes completely uninhabitable by the sane. This state of affairs is called dharmasya glani, or misuse of the energy of the human being. When such misuse of human energy is prominent, the saner living beings become perturbed by the awkward situation created by the vicious administrators, who are simply burdens of the earth. And the Lord appears by His internal potency just to save the saner section of humanity and to alleviate the burden due to the earthly administrators in different parts of the world. He does not favor either of the unwanted administrators, but by His potential power, He creates hostility between such unwanted administrators, as the air creates fire in the forest by the friction of the bamboos. The fire in the forest takes place automatically by the force of the air, and similarly, the hostility between different groups of politicians takes place by the unseen design of the Lord. The unwanted administrators, puffed up by false power and military strength, thus become engaged in fighting amongst themselves over ideological conflicts and so exhaust themselves of all powers. The history of the world reflects this factual will of the Lord, and it will continue to be enacted until the living beings are attached to the service of the Lord. In the Bhagavad Gita, this fact is very vividly described. It is said, "The deluding energy is my potency, and thus it is not possible for the dependent living beings to supersede the strength of the material modes. But those who take shelter in me, the personality of Godhead Sri Krishna, can cross over the gigantic ocean of material energy." This means that no one can establish peace and prosperity in the world by fruitive activities or by speculative philosophy or ideology. The only way is to surrender unto the Supreme Lord and thus become free from the illusion of the deluding energy. Unfortunately, persons who are engaged in destructive work are unable to surrender to the personality of Godhead. They are all fools of the first order. They are the lowest of the human species of life. They are robbed of their knowledge, although apparently they seem to be academically educated. They are all of the demoniac mentality, always challenging the supreme power of the Lord. Those who are very materialistic, always hankering after material power and strength, are undoubtedly fools of the first order, because they have no information of the living energy. And being ignorant of that supreme spiritual science, they are absorbed in material science, which ends with the end of the material body. They are the lowest of human beings because the human life is especially meant for re-establishing the lost relation with the Lord, and they miss this opportunity by being engaged in material activities. They are robbed of their knowledge because even after prolonged speculation, they cannot return, they cannot reach to the stage of knowing the personality of Godhead, the summum bonum of everything. And all of them are men of demoniac principle, and they suffer the consequences, as did such materialistic heroes as Ravana, Hiranyakashipu, Kamsa, and others. Srila Prabhupada ki. Om Agyanati Miranyasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshuran Malitam Yenatasma. Well, that's quite a cheerful purport to start the day with. And this is one of Prabhupada's uncompromising purports. He doesn't mince his words. There's not too much flowery language here. This is giving us the message as it is, real, raw, and with full conviction. This whole episode is very interesting. There has been a whole battle of Kurukshetra, which has taken place some time prior to this event. And the Lord is entering Dwarka, and various qualities and attributes of the Lord are being described. As he's entering Dwarka, we read in the previous verses how he is received very nicely by the citizens. And he's in a pleasant mood and he reciprocates with them. Well, this verse explains how it is that the Lord is in a pleasant mood. And this is one of the points that he has rid the earth of the Dharmaglani. Through this entire battle, through this war, all the troublesome factions which were causing a burden to Mother Earth have been eliminated. So in this verse it said, he was pacified. He himself was not a party in the fight, and he was pacified. So the Lord is pleased actually when the correct order of things is established. He allows everyone to play their part, and he allows everyone to enact their fantasies. This material world is we describe it as a phantasmagoria. It is a place where people can act out the fantasy that they can be the controller, the Lord, the enjoyer. And the Lord is so kind that he doesn't actively prevent someone from doing that. He creates an entire material world where they can do that. He creates a playground, essentially. This world is described as a playground, where the naughty conditioned souls come and play. And in one place, Prabhupada says, this is just like the playing cradle that's given to the baby. And the baby is crying, it is put inside the playing cradle, and it plays for a little while. So this material world is like the playing cradle, where the naughty conditioned souls who are mischievous, they get a chance to come here and play as much as they want. Of course, there are a few things that trouble them along the way. Birth, old age, disease, death, the three kleshas. And so their pleasure-seeking propensities are always challenged at every moment. And the idea is that through that process of being repeatedly challenged and through repeatedly failing to enjoy and control and manipulate, the living entities become reformed. They lose their conditioning. They become reformed and re-energized to go back to a saner way of living. So I found it interesting that Prabhupada focuses on the sane human beings. He says that the Lord appears by his internal potency just to save the saner section of humanity. He doesn't come to save everyone. Now ultimately the Lord is everyone's well-wisher. But especially he is there to protect the saner persons. Yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata adbhutanam dharmasya tadatmanam srijamyaham. Wherever there is a decline of religious practice and a predominant rise of irreligion, I descend myself. Paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya cha duskritam dharma samsthapanarthaya sambhavami yuge yuge. That he comes to establish the principles of religion and to protect the pious and to annihilate the miscreants. And that's the Lord's mission. So he comes to protect those who behave in a way that allows human life to be realized. The Dharmaglani, the other disturbing factors, they simply conduct multiple activities. Multiple activities without any direction, without any sense of the correct goal, and just activities conducted out of passion with a philosophical basis of ignorance that simply entangle living entities again and again, life after life, birth after birth. And not just single births, but this is multiple, millions, millions of births. Once someone is stuck in this cycle of samsara, there is no quick exit. One has to go through all these species of life, the 4 million species or so. And of those, some of them are humans. Some of those of the human category, some are civilized, as Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu explains. So when we actually come to a point that we're in a human form of life, we have a human body, and we happen to have a conducive situation where we have a sense of civilization, that is to be taken as the greatest opportunity. Because that is actually the only option for exiting this cycle of samsara. Apart from that, and apart from our conscious efforts, there isn't much hope. There is a chance, of course, that if you happen to be in one of the other species, maybe as a fish or a bird or something, that somehow, by some fortune, by some sukriti, you may come across some mahaprasadam or the mercy of a devotee. And that is described as a powerful method for benefiting those species. But really, there is nothing actively that they can do themselves to rid themselves of their situation. And they certainly cannot engage in a methodical, prolonged, or considered process of devotional service, because they simply do not have the faculties that are required. So Krishna is very kind. There is always a section of society which will be sane and a section which will be insane. And if we go back to Satya Yuga, we can understand that pretty much society was sane. There were individuals there in a situation where they were functioning to act for their ultimate welfare. And they would engage in different processes. And as we know, as time goes on, as the ages develop, Treta, Dwapar, Kali Yuga, then the sane population of society, the proportion decreases, and the insane increases. So we can imagine what it's like at the end of Kali Yuga. And as we read the description in the Bhagavatam, in the 12th canto, and other places, we will see what happens in Kali Yuga. It's not pleasant. It's nothing to look forward to. And we do have a very good taster of it right now. It's not anywhere near as developed as it will be later. But we still get a sense of multiple agendas, multiple directions, driven by insanity. These days there is the actual reference point has been thrown out. This purport explains that the reference point is the Lord. The Lord's will, the Lord's desire. But that reference point has been thrown out from most systems of government. And the reference point is now the opinions of the masses, or the opinions of a select group of people selected by the masses. And so they become the lawmakers. Which is okay, because you still need a mechanism by which you implement laws and you judge whether people are complying with them, and then you need executive functions to carry out different aspects as dictated by the laws. That's all very good. But the ultimate reference point, which in today's society has been pretty much removed constitutionally, is the reference point of God. Because ultimately, laws are created by God. Real religious principles are created by the Lord. They're not created by anyone else. So, this is the mistake that we are laboring under now. That whenever a certain group, a certain faction campaigns for something to be done, if there are enough voices around the table to support that, without necessarily having a scriptural or an authoritative reference, that could be accepted as legitimate, providing enough people sign up to that philosophy. That's very dangerous, because it means that progressively, as sections of society become more and more insane, the proportion of insanity increases. The decisions that will be made will be progressively more and more insane. There's no two ways around it. It's a simple formula. If insanity increases, the decisions and persons selected will be increasingly insane. In some parts of the world, this is further developed than in others. And we're fortunate in this country that there are some semblance of decent law, order. Of course, it is all under challenge. But at least we have some functioning institutions, we have some systems, we have methods by which someone's rights can be respected. Now, in some parts of the world, that's not the case. It's gone completely. It is the whims of whoever happens to have usurped control. So we're fortunate, but we can understand that it is a very fragile situation. There is no telling at which point the insane agenda will overtake the sane agenda. And in Kali Yuga, it is guaranteed to happen. It's just a question of when. So it is a precarious situation. And when situations like this develop too much, as happened just prior to the start of Kali Yuga, the Lord intervenes sometimes. But the way he intervenes is very special. Of course, he can directly take action. There are so many pastimes where he takes action. Towards the end of the purport, Prabhupada speaks about Ravana, Hiranyakashipu, Kamsa, and others. The Lord directly intervened and dealt with these nefarious individuals. He's quite capable. He's fully potent. He's the original progenitor. He has full potency, strength, virya, everything. But typically, although in this purport it's described that the Lord, you know, he creates the enmity between different factions. That's how it's described here, just like the air creates friction. And then the bamboos rub against each other, and then the fire starts. Well, what is the cause of the fire in that scenario? Who do you blame? Do you blame the wind? Do you blame the bamboo? Ultimately, it's the bamboo that's burning, but it's been instigated by the air. So who is the cause? It's complicated. So with Krishna, when he wants to, he will take direct action. At other times, he will be the unseen actor or the unseen puppet master. But what's also interesting is that we should not use this to label the Lord as a despot controller. Now, there are many aspects of the Lord that people like. They like his merciful nature. They like his cuddly, compassionate nature. They like, you know, when he jumps in to save the poor, when he jumps in to save a person who is suffering from the greatest calamity, cures someone of a disease. People like that aspect of him. Many movies are made on this principle. And this, in many religions, is one of the motivating factors for many devotees. We also have these aspects in our own culture. Because the Lord is so amazing that he does many amazing things. And some of those amazing things do include helping his devotees, helping others, showing mercy to others. So we have many stories like that, Dhruva Maharaj and others, where the Lord does something which seems materially amazing, Sudama. But that is not the real mercy of the Lord in one sense. The Lord does all of that. But the real mercy of the Lord is in how he saves someone from the repeated cycle of birth and death. And that is a little more tricky to understand. Now here, so the other dimension is, there's the Lord's helpful nature, so the Lord's materially beneficial nature. But then there is also the Lord's help, which comes through his external energy. So the Lord sometimes appears to be causing distress. And as it said in this verse, he creates enmity amongst individuals. So we could label him as being a troublemaker. He's stirring the situation. You know, some people, they are too afraid to take action themselves. So what they do, they stir up situation amongst different groups of individuals, hoping that those two will fight it out, and then they will be free to enjoy the results, the spoils. They're protected. Well, Krishna is not a coward who needs to do that. Krishna employs such tactics. He's very clever. He does this. He does this tactic with Muchukunda, for example. Krishna uses some other agent to deal with a very difficult circumstance. But he doesn't have to. So when Krishna does it, it's quite different to when human beings with their agendas and manipulative tendencies do it. Prabhupada says in the Gita that Arjuna was the warrior who would lead from the front. He wouldn't be stuck in some dusty office sending commands. He would be on the battlefield leading, commanding the army. And Krishna does this. So we have to understand that when we hear of the Lord acting indirectly, and that's the main theme here in this verse, he acts indirectly. He does, but he doesn't do. We should know that there's something deeper going on. Because the Lord is not a coward who is unable to act directly. So what is it that's happening that causes the Lord to behave indirectly? Well, in one sense, it's not directly the Lord, it's not the Lord's direct impetus. It is something to do with us. When we're preaching, when we're distributing books, sometimes when people are interested, we try to make them understand or try to help them understand that what is happening in this life is a consequence of things that have happened in the past, decisions, actions that have taken. There is a cycle. So you could say the earthquake came, the volcano erupted, great tragedy, great loss happened. And yes, that's true. And we could automatically blame God. Because after all, if he's in charge of this all, he can stop the volcano. He can just reduce its potency. He can fix the earthquake. Whatever the plates are doing underneath, he could just repair that if he wanted. So it's his fault. But we don't consider that actually for all the individuals, all the different entities who are affected by that, they are simply getting the results, the consequences of something that has happened in the past due to them. So who is to blame? There's the Lord's external energy which is causing certain results to be brought about. But the deserving of those results has been created by us in the past. We deserve something like that happening to us. Therefore, the Lord has created a mechanism by which it is delivered to us. So who is to blame? Do you blame the mechanism? Do you blame the person who caused the problem in the first place? If the police arrest a criminal, who do we blame? Do we look at the police and say, wow, these are really violent, heavy, oppressive persons. Look, they've just arrested a person. They may have even shot the person. They are really dreadful people. Who's to blame? It's definitely not the police, is it? It's the criminal. It's the criminal who has done something wrong, who is now getting the results of their actions delivered to them through some agent. And when an individual acts and behaves in a certain way, Krishna has a whole range of agents who ensure the system continues properly. And his agents are the multiple soldiers of the material energy. They are all his servants. And they act to carry out wishes so that the earth is again inhabited, populated, or directed by the saner section of society. So it's very interesting. Krishna has these two dimensions. He likes to protect, but he's also not sad when those who are not worthy of protection are destroyed. He says that himself in towards the end of the Gita, in the chapter on divine and demoniac natures, that those who are miscreant, grossly foolish, they're accustomed to demoniac ways. Shri Shri Radha Gokulananda Ki Jai. He says he casts them repeatedly into the oceans of birth and death. So now I'm sure we've all come across different preachers who preach to us something like this, that do this, 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 or you will suffer in hell eternally. So it could seem that this verse is a bit like that, that for those who are miscreant, those who do not render devotional service, I cast them repeatedly into the ocean of birth and death. But again, if we follow the same logic that we were just discussing, that the fact that someone is going to be cast into the ocean of birth and death, we look at the role of the caster as the role of the police. You know, the police will capture someone, put them in custody. So Krishna's agents will capture someone and cast them into the material world. But based upon the fact that they need to be there, based upon the fact that they deserve to be there, so Krishna is interesting because this dimension is there, that he wants a system. He wants a system where reform can happen. And reform typically does not happen without punishment. Punishment is never the goal, but it is sadly something that is needed. If through practice, if through education, if through developing good qualities or attempting to develop good qualities, a person doesn't get the message, sometimes having their humility really brought to the front helps. After all, no government likes to maintain prisons. Prabhupada says they're an expensive arrangement in society. But still, every government will maintain a prison, even at such expense, because it is necessary. And the persons in there definitely do not get the same liberties as those outside, but they need to be there for the purpose of reform. So Krishna is interesting. On the one hand, he casts people into this ocean of material birth and death. But on the other hand, he also acts as a hand that brings them out. Yetu sarvani karmani mai sanyasya matparah ananyaneva yogena mam dhyayanta upasate teshamaham samuttharata mritya samsara sagarat bhavamina chirat partha maya veshita chetasam. So Krishna explains very nicely that for those who are completely devoted to him, who render service to him, whose entire life action is completely pure, undeviated, for them he acts as the swift deliverer from the ocean of birth and death. It's as if he reaches down inside that ocean where we're swimming and just pulls us out, gives us a hand and simply pulls us out. That is Krishna's merciful, magnanimous nature. And the qualifications for receiving such mercy are described in that verse. And they're very interesting. One has to be engaged in undeviated, fixed, firm devotional service. Now again, if we could apply a similar argument, and it seems that Krishna is saying that unless you surrender to me, unless you do whatever I want, unless you serve me exclusively, I won't help you. Isn't it? That's a typical, certainly I've had that leveled at me as an accusation against Krishna. That Krishna says, unless you give him your entire surrender, you know, he's not going to do anything for you. That's rather puffed up, or they use many other terms to describe that. But again, is Krishna to blame? No, let's follow that very carefully. If one engages in uninterrupted, undeviated, focused devotional service for the pleasure of the Lord, what does that mean? That means they are accruing no sinful actions, no sinful reactions. The moment any of our activities are separate from the Lord, we are accruing something, piety or sin. Both of those are the cause of us being in this material ocean. So nothing short of complete avoidance of increasing and incurring karma in this world will save us from being here in this world. It's a very deep point, because we may think that, okay, I'll do a little bit of devotional service and it'll be nice. I'll keep my material life going. I'll do a little devotional service and I'll go back to Krishna. Well, yes, whatever devotional service we do, that will take us back to Krishna, as soon as we've done enough of it, right? There's no loss or diminution on this path, but we do start from a certain point. Whatever we've reached, 39%, Prabhupada says in one place, we start from the next point, 40% in our next life. So we will get there. But the fact is that all the other non-devotional things that we've done, they are also increasing our ticket in this hotel. They are increasing the duration of our stay here. And that means we're going to be swimming around in this material pool for longer. So complete unmotivated, unalloyed devotional service is the only thing actually that will save us from difficulties, that will save us from being dharmasya glani. Krishna is, he says things as they are. He's very straightforward. He doesn't have to be shy when he presents his own position, because he actually is of that character. Sometimes many politicians will try to glorify themselves as being great in this manner or that manner. Not just politicians, anyone does this. We see politicians particularly because we see them on the screen all the time. But it applies to anyone. The head of a company, the head of a family maybe, the head teacher in a school. They think themselves to be great. And they think that I need to ensure that others around me see that I am a very great, competent person. Krishna has no such interest. He has no such need. He's not someone who needs such ego flattering, because he has no ego. He's factually, indisputably, the Supreme Lord. That position is not up for challenge. Many miscreants challenge it, and they fail. Ravan, Hiranyakashipu, Kamsa, some examples that Prabhupada gives, they challenge Krishna's position, but because they are not of that position, then they can never be in the position of Krishna, they fail miserably. So Krishna, when he says, I am the Supreme Lord of everything, a wise person engages in my service, he is saying things as they are, without a tinge of ego. And it is very useful for us as fallen conditioned souls to accept that very seriously. And if we actually move towards, progressively, we move towards the stage of being engaged in Krishna's service exclusively, then our proportionate contribution to our stay in this hotel, as I said, is decreasing. And that is a good result. Because the longer we are here, the more the troubles we will experience. So I'll stop there and see if anyone has any questions, comments.